So before we take a break, I'll talk a little bit, kind of a recap of the last time we were together, the talk, and it's probably going to be a whole new talk. I can't really remember what I said back then, but I got some notes. But this poem touches into something I think is so poignant with social engagement or social justice, however you look at it. Is this notion of being afraid. We are always afraid as humans because life is so uncertain. There's so much impermanence. It is the nature, the phenomena of our existence for fear to be there. So when we get still, the first thing anyone notices is how much we're afraid all the time, worried about this, worried about that. Just this constant, never satisfied energy, never thinking that it's going to work out, always having to somehow control things. So when we come into the practice, there's a way in which we can, I think the practice helps us balance the two realities. This ultimate reality towards altruistic liberation and relative reality, that's the everyday stuff that we deal with, that somehow in our practice, we are all balancing that. And I think the Buddha understood that. It's why it's called the middle way, because there's a requirement for monastics to be a part of a community, to be connected to a village and be connected to people, or they wouldn't be able to survive. They need that village. They need the community. They need people to help them with their basic needs, like eating and having a place to stay and having robes, just basic stuff. But at the same time, communities need monastics, teachers of the Dhamma, to point to some altruistic thing, that it's not just the drudgery of our everyday lives, that there's something, some aspiration out there that the mind can aspire to that goes way beyond what our houses look like, whether or not we have the job we like, or, you know, what we're eating. It's way beyond that. So I think our practice is somehow practicing in the balancing of these two worlds. Another way to think about it is, as practitioners, we are always trying to see the truth of the way things are. That's the phrasing we always use. I want to see the truth of the way things are. And so we're looking for how to see that truth. It's an altruistic kind of liberative truth of wisdom that we're looking for. And that truth, the very nature of it, is dependent origination. It is the awareness of causality, the awareness that things are conditional, that experience is conditional, life is conditional. And when conditions come together, something happens. And when things, conditions fall apart, something else happens. Because of this, there is that. Because of that, there is this. If there's no that, there's no this. If there's no this, there's no that. It's very conditional. But to see that dependent origination requires us to see past our views through our opinions, our judgments, our basically our relative reality. We have to see the relative reality and then see through it. At the same time, if we didn't have dukkha, the altruistic life that we could point towards, our aspirations They don't have any meat to them. To just look for relaxation or even tranquility and peace does not come without the uplift of pity. And pity sometimes can be a good feeling, but most times it's a little rough. It's a little intense. Somehow, dukkha being the doorway into liberation, dukkha being this suffering into liberation is what helps us begin to balance both of them. And the more we balance our altruistic understanding with the relative reality of dukkha, of suffering, of impermanence, and things are always changing, and conditionality, and how impersonal the world is, the more we're able to see that, then I think what Audre Lorde is pointing to is there's no point not to speak. There's no point not to just be active. Just be in the midst of it. There's no point to try to ascend beyond the difficulties of this world because it doesn't exist. The Buddha tried to ascend beyond it and it didn't work. So what I think our practice is really pointing to is somehow learning how to be in this world as it is. I mean, be in this world as it is. Not be in the world when we figured out climate change, because the idea of being with the realization of how messed up the climate is might scare the living daylights out of us. But that reality is the relative reality we live in. And to not be with that suffering and still believe in a, not a better union, so to speak, like in politics, but to believe in a human existence where we begin to have a care for all beings. We begin to care for the earth and we begin to care for each other. To hold that as an altruistic, ultimate understanding is beautiful. I mean, that is both the middle way. But if you carry the pain of climate change and the aversion of your anger towards all the people that are blowing it off and making things worse, then you can't really hold this view of this ultimate kind of altruistic place where we will come to an understanding of harm and the harm that's caused to other people. So somehow we have to hold both the unwholesome roots of beings and the wholesome roots of being simultaneously. And our practice is learning to balance that. I also think that there is so much harm in the world. There's so much harm in the world. There's so much pain and suffering in the world. There are so many issues in the world that we need not figure out how to solve them all. It's more about finding that social connection with a larger good. Finding what you love, what interests you, where your heart resonates. and do your work there. To try to get caught, to try to be at the edge where you're always working in all the various areas where there needs help and tending to, we can get lost. And I think I talked about this when we talked at the beginning of the month, but this idea of compassion fatigue drives me crazy. There's no such thing as compassion fatigue. You can't have fatigue with compassion because compassion is not you. It's not, it can't get fatigued. But we get fatigued. And I can see where we can have empathetic fatigue, or we could have sympathetic fatigue, but not compassion, because compassion does not belong to any one of us. It exists where there is suffering, regardless of how long the suffering exists. It is not tied to any of my efforts. We can care and care and care and care and care and care and care forever. There's no reason to stop caring if they're suffering, because our access to the caring is not coming from relative reality. It's coming from ultimate reality. Our willingness to feel the suffering, to acknowledge the suffering, is relative reality. And sometimes I think we may grow weary of acknowledging the amount of suffering in the world. So one thing that has really supported me is that I do not try to solve all the world's problems. I have about four things that really mean a lot to me, and I work in those areas. That's what I work with. I love and I care about people who are incarcerated. I care about the suffering of people incarcerated. I care about victims of crimes. And I care about the suffering of people who suffer a crime and get thrown off balance and not knowing how to get themselves right. So I do a lot of work and try to do a lot of support for criminal justice. I'm not always working on criminal justice, but that's one of the pet peeves. So that's where I look for ways I can help. I have a tender spot for people in recovery. I've never been in recovery for substance abuse, but I definitely feel like I've been in recovery for all kinds of addictive behaviors. And so there's a part of me that always wants to support and do what I can to help those in recovery. I care about senseless violence. I care about violence, period, and especially senseless violence towards children. So I care about finding ways to help people who work on senseless violence. And then lastly, I care about, I don't know how to describe this, but I care about people on welfare with very little education, and people who don't seem to, they don't have access to all the wisdom. And so I try to help people in shelters, people who are kind of like the throwaway people in society. And mostly I care about these four things, not because I think these four things are more important than any of the other things. I don't really have that much energy around climate change. I don't have a lot of energy around homelessness, other than if you're stuck in a shelter or something like that. But I don't have a lot of energy around racial issues, and I don't have a lot of energy around domestic violence. There's all kinds of things. I don't have a lot of energy around animals or the cruelty to animals, things like that. There's just deforestation. I could go on forever. I don't have a lot of energy around these other things. And mostly it's because the four things I care about are the four things I've lived through my whole life. And they are the four things that mean, the four areas that mean something to me. It's not a heavy lift for me to help and support people in those four areas. So there's no, it's inherently connected to my practice. And so the flow of it is with the practice. I just think if every single practitioner found some areas of social concern that meant a lot to them, that is not a heavy lift, that's just part of their life, things they've gone through, then the amount of practitioners we actually have would make a huge difference in the world. But I find oftentimes practitioners are so on the altruistic, ultimate reality type of practice that the coarseness and rigidity of the relative reality, it gets too coarse, too tension filled, and it's hard to be with it unless you get used to being with that tension. So that's really why I wanted us to talk about social engagement and social justice this month. Because I want us to, as practitioners, learn to be with that tension of the difficulties and the harm in the world. I don't have much of the harm of the people I work with, the agencies I work with, the people I give money to, all of it. I no longer live in those places anymore. But I still have a close intimacy with it and the pain of it. I never let the pain of homelessness, or it's not homelessness, it's just being marginalized. That I have lived as a throwaway person on welfare. I know what it feels like. I don't let that pain go away from me. That's the difference. And so somehow in practice, if we are always practicing to get away from pain or get away from difficulty and finding a way where it's just easy and smooth, we have to get further and further and further and further and further away from society, because it's never going to be easy and smooth when we live with a group of people, all of us, who have greed, hatred, and delusion as our underlying tendencies. So we are always going to rub up against some harm. And it's finding the harm out there in the world that you resonate with. And then you work with those people. You let me work on mine. You work on yours. Everybody's going to work on theirs. And together, we can work on all of it. Yeah. So I'm going to read Audre Lorde one more time and close. For those of us who live at the shoreline, standing upon the edge, the constant edges of decision, crucial and alone. For those of us who cannot indulge the passing dreams of choice. I know you know that. Who love in doorways coming and going in the hours between dawn, looking inward and outward at once, before and after, seeking a now that can breed futures like bread in our children's mouths, so their dreams will not reflect the death of ours. I don't know too many parents that don't feel that. For those of us who were imprinted with fear, like a constant, like a faint line in the center of our foreheads, learning to be afraid with our mother's milk, by this weapon, this illusion for some safety can be found. The heavy-footed hoped to silence us. You know, we all know fear. We were born into fear. We were born with parents who constantly was afraid and put that fear in us. So for all of us, this instant and this triumph, we were never meant to survive. And when the sun rises, we are afraid it might not remain. When the sun sets, we are afraid it might not rise in the morning. When our stomachs are full, we are afraid of indigestion. When our stomachs are empty, we are afraid we may not eat again. When we are loved, we are afraid love will vanish. When we are alone, we are afraid love will never return. When we speak, we are afraid our words will not be heard, not welcome. But when we are silent, we are still afraid. We are always afraid. Every one of us, especially in this country, we are seriously afraid. So it is better to speak, remembering we were never meant to survive. That we were never meant to survive. What that sounds like to me is, for a practitioner, we are all going to die. We were not meant to live forever. We were meant to die. And because of that, if we let our fear control where we go, how we are, what we do, how much we give ourselves to the world, we are letting the wrong thing guide us. But if we let our courage, the wisdom that knows we were never meant to survive, we were always going to die, then we can take on anything. Nothing is going to keep us from death. So let's sit a moment with this. All right. So we're going to take a 5-minute break. And those of you who are, I guess, on Zoom, if you don't want to participate in the breakout rooms, this would be a good time to say goodbye. We're going to set up rooms into 3 or 4, and then we're going to come back. And the question that I have that you can begin to contemplate during the break is, how balanced are you in holding these two realities? both the ultimate reality and the relative reality. And if you're not very balanced, what do you think your practice could do to help you balance it? So we will come back at 10 after and get into groups of threes and fours. All right. I hope that was a awakening kind of conversation so that you could begin to see how we all are struggling to balance this these two realities together, and that I think our practice is designed to get us to help us do that, find that balance between the realities. But I don't know. What do you guys think? Let's see if anybody has any comments they want to share. Yeah, go ahead, David. Can he unmute? Okay, there you go, David.
Oh, now, can you hear me okay now?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Something that occurred to me just right at the end, I'll save that for a second, but one of the things that I've been working with for a while is how to live in a way where, like, I just enjoy your life, because we could be dead tomorrow. And then also, like, how do we plan to be like 100? You know, it is something that we sort of have to do, especially without a lot of social safety net and other things, really, yeah, like support. And then the thing at the end that occurred to me that I was sharing with the group was, think in terms of like, what is something that we could do that our practice is just inherently, especially even an exercise like that, is just inherently equipping us to do, is just to support other people with the not, even, there's an interaction, but like not really offering a ton of advice, or just how to do like good dharmic listening, like practice listening, because I'm noticing so much distraughtness as I started to socialize more with people that are not in my dharma circles. Like, it's really palpable, like the sense of distress and not okay, like a feeling of I'm not okay.
Yeah.
And I think there's a way that what we do each week with this is just holding people, and if we can take that and just a sense of centered awareness and listening, that's a real gift that we can just do. That's also like not really having to look for what we're doing all the time.
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true, because the world really doesn't have a lot of people that just holds and listen. That's why I have such a negative energy around the word compassion fatigue, because compassion doesn't require anything of us. It's just it's our practice. It's being with suffering as it is, without trying to fix it and change it and make it right and do anything about it. And that being is exactly what you're describing. It's something that we do every time we sit down. We sit down and we be with suffering, the unpleasantness of our own sit. And so it's just part of that. Great, thank you.
Here, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, you have to use that so that people can hear you.
Yeah, that's just a great segue for me. If meditation tends to, but not always, make you more sensitive, I personally become a little bit more suffering avoidant with respect to kind of the relative world, the layperson world that we're talking about. And so in some ways, it's like my practice is pushing me away from helping socially, and although I tend to give out power bars and stuff on the street corners to homeless, but I guess my question is more of a practical one, but you know, it's like in some ways my capacity is getting larger, but it's also shrinking because of the sensitivity. And I was just curious.
So I'm assuming because we use the mic, I don't have to repeat the question. Okay. So what I would say is this. Practice brings discernment. So your discernment might very well be these various social issues in the world I can't get involved with because of my level of sensitivity. That's discernment. But in the world, the nature of difficulty and suffering, it is huge. It's immense. So if you want to be engaged in some aspect of a greater good for the world, it does not have to be in the usual social ways that we give. It does not mean that you have to get involved and be all in people's suffering. It means that you're wanting to contribute to the larger good of the world, whatever that looks like, however that shows up, and whatever fits within your own capacity to be able to handle it. And practice is what actually helps you discern the line between when I've had too much and when I've had enough. That's what it's helping you see. Otherwise, you'd flood yourself out there and you're overwhelming your own system. It's sort of like the meditation, learning to practice the line between movement and stillness, or learning to practice not being impulsively pushing away when some unpleasantness happens, and not grasping after or trying to hold on to some pleasant that shows up. The discernment you're learning is not, I don't want to have any unpleasant, or I don't want to have any pleasant, or I'm only going to be with the unpleasant. You're not learning that as discernment. You're learning to be able to balance your reactivity in relation to whatever arises. Likewise, in social engagement, your discernment is saying, I'm getting really, really sensitive. So this stuff out here is too much right now. But if there is a value within you that says, but I really want to contribute to the greater good, then look for something that allows you to do that. And there are many social issues, but it allows you to contribute to the greater good without feeling that have to energy of working, you know, with certain groups or certain situations. Do you see?
Yeah, back to your comment.
Get to use the mic.
But back to your comment about just finding something that resonates with your heart, like your four things.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
That's it. So you just find that thing that resonates with your heart, even if it's just giving money to support organizations that do that work. They'll take that money. They need it too. Right. So it's, you're still contributing greatly to the world.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
So you're all balanced. Is that, is this my understanding? That's a good teaching. That means that in 1 month, we got it all balanced.
Tori, I want to just say one more quick thing. Actually, you helped me like weeks ago. Something that you said really did make a difference, a profound shift, was I think you're talking about how we're taking heat for some comments you made about climate change and stuff. And you're just like, how do you figure out, how are we going to live with it? Basically, I could be paraphrasing it incorrectly, but like that really landed for me and it made a difference. And that's been with me for this whole month, basically. And that is kind of the question is, before everything gets fixed, we do have to live with whatever's going on. And that was profound. So I just want to thank you for that.
No, you're welcome. I'm glad, David, that you got some steadiness out of my suffering. Because it was kind of rough in the room. I kind of felt the heat kind of growing in there. Like, did I say something? It was getting kind of hot. But, you know, social justice, social engagement, this is an awkward topic. It's awkward because it carries so much weight to it. But it only carries weight because the issues are enormous and we live in fix it mind. So there's this enormous need to fix these problems. And it's not, we can't fix them. Yeah, Kathy. Oh, hold on 1 second, Beth. Go ahead.
I'll be quick. I just wanted to say again, I was in the same group with David and, we agreed on that having you say a couple weeks ago that we were living in a changing climate and how are we going to do that was so profound. It was so helpful. And we were talking tonight about how much the homelessness and the garbage and all the problems were bothering. You know, when you go downtown, you don't feel safe. It's ugly, all this. And I was thinking the same way. Maybe my approach needs to shift a little bit here. I'm living in a city that's having these problems. And I'm going to be living with this. And but surely there's some way I can just contribute some money or something that might help, help alleviate it.
Yes. Yes, you can. But if you're working under the requirement to fix it, that's the problem. We can't, when it comes to social, hold on a second. When it comes to social engagement, if you're operating under, I'm going to fix the problem, we are setting ourselves up for a lot of pain. It doesn't work like that. The best way I can describe it is this. We live in a human body that has the underlying tendency for greed, hatred, and delusion. We got to get that. That means everybody in this room, everybody on this call, everybody in Seattle, everybody in the States, in Canada, Mexico, all the way over to China, all of us are greedy. We are trying to get what we want and we're trying to get rid of what we don't want. If we were all enlightened beings, we would not operate under that energy, but we are not. So there are billions of people on this planet whose root cause, root way of acting, not because they're bad people, but because we're born human, the root impulse of our lives is to get what we want and not get what we don't want. That is the root cause of it. That's all we want to do. So you take a billion people, 10 billion people, 8 billion people, however many billions of people on the earth, you take all of us. There's a few enlightened beings out there, so they're excluded. But you take all of us and you put us in a small little planet here and we are going to start harming each other constantly, all day long. So one perspective to put into this mix is, if everything is about fixing the problem, then we got to fix all these billions of people in order for this to ever stop. And that is why it doesn't work to try to fix the problem. But in order to be with the problem, you just need to come to a practice understanding of suffering. That's it, which is the nature of our practice, to be with suffering. It is the doorway to awakening. So we know how to be with suffering, and that's all that is asked of us, to be with suffering at whatever level it is. And that being with suffering is where our liberation comes from. It does not come from, we finally fix that whole homeless situation. All right, so Beth, let's see what you'd like to say for us.
Now that you've spoken, I don't have, you just took the words out of my mouth. I'll go from what you said, but being with the suffering. And as y'all were talking, I was thinking about our practice of aiming and sustaining and the concentration I've discovered. And we were talking in our group of that concentration, which is the practical end of things. It's using, you know, focusing the mind, aiming and sustaining. It calms things down in the binary operating system enough so that the wisdom voice can come through.
Yep.
And that we can make choices. There were just four people in this group, and everyone has looked at a social problem and is addressing it in their own way, be it from helping a homeless shelter, protesting. And I have to believe, and I'd like to share an example of something that a fruit that has come about. On the east side, Seattle's east side, there's been a consortium of people since 1994 who've been hosting homeless men in churches and synagogues since 1994. And they've done this with the aiming and sustaining and collecting and unifying. And just this past summer, they got a permit, a King County permit, to build a permanent shelter.
Yeah.
So, you know, in 1994, nobody imagined that might be happening, but they've done that. And that kind of action brings me hope.
Yeah.
And it helps me continue to try to aim and sustain.
Yeah. That's great. Thank you. Bob?
Hi, everybody. I've been thinking, where does joy fit into this story? We're pretty good at identifying the suffering. It seems like a real challenge for everybody right now is finding any joy. And the joy we do find doesn't seem adequate enough for people. They're like, well, sure, it's a beautiful fall day. So, but really, there's a lot of worse things happening.
Yeah.
So I've been thinking about I've been thinking about a conversation you had with, I think it's Steve, in the Thursday night group about finding joy.
Oh, yes.
Coexistent with suffering.
Joy is a necessary, it's like putting your clothes on. You're going to have your clothes on when you go outside. So you're going to have some joy if you're going to do this practice. You can't do it without the joy, because somewhere you have to have the uplift. It's like the rapture, the pity in awakening factors is what comes before the tranquility. You have to have a great deal of energy in order to have a calm mind, steady mind that gets an equanimous mind. It comes on the heels of a lot of energy and a lot of uplift. So to me, that's what joy is. Even though we talk about the civil rights movement, we usually talk about it in this humdrum kind of all the misery of it. And it's not that I'm not saying there wasn't any misery, but oh my God, in some of the church services of some of those nights before protest, I remember listening to this interview with people talking about the way some of those church services was early mornings before they would go to Woolworth to sit at these lunch counters, or late nights, they'd have these church services, and if their voices could have raised the roof off of that church, it would have, because the level of heightened joy and faith and just love and capacity gets built into it. That's how you go sit at that lunch counter. You don't sit at the lunch counter with somebody yelling and screaming at you like, I'm going to bear and take it. Tuareg's going to be here and I'm going to take it. I'm going to take it. It's not like that. You have to let go of yourself so that the person that's sitting at the lunch counter is just another human being sitting there on behalf of all the beings. And that level of letting go doesn't come from dwelling on the problem that needs to be fixed. It comes from the altruistic side of knowing there's something bigger, better, brighter, that you're holding on to, that there's a greater good that you're holding on to. So that's where that joy comes from. It doesn't come from, it won't come if your joy is going to come from fixing the problem, because we can't fix it. It's too big. It's got to come from just the opportunity to be doing something greater than yourself. Let's see. I thought I saw another hand up, but.
Tuareg, was me, Bruce.
Okay, Bruce.
I have a direct result of trying to fix myself for 45 years. It doesn't work. All I can do, what does work is accepting the fact that I'm this way and that I can't change it, and accepting the way it is.
Yes.
This doesn't work.
Bruce, that's so deep, the inside level of that. And that, it's amazing how all of us know that we have all tried to fix ourselves, and we are the exact same people we were years ago, 40 years ago, when we started this process. All the money we spent. And yet we still believe that we should be able to fix the world outside of us. We can't even fix it here. And we think we should fix out there.
Right.
I do know this.
Yeah. So the calmer I can be, the calmer I can be, the better the world is.
That's right. Yep. That's right. It means something to say that we want to be with life the way it actually is. It means something. Yeah. Go ahead, Austin.
And the way it actually is, from a Nietzsche, is always changing.
Yes.
It's never the same.
Never.
So I think that for me, I love this term transformation to because it's different than change. It's like, it's a qualitative difference. I heard somebody say once that the difference between transformation and change is, in a transformation, there's no residue of the past. And you just think about like trans to move across and then form a different form. And in my own practice, I just, when I sit, I can observe the transformation that's happening all around us all the time.
All the time.
And reflecting, and I think some of it is impatience, that we want it to change in our time.
Yeah.
And in our way. But, you know, good farmers, I've never farmed, but I hear that you can't force the crop to grow.
No.
You can water it. You can make sure the soil's fertile. And there's sometimes I do feel, though, that, you know, we can try and lay the seeds for something.
Yes, we can.
And we can cultivate, and that's what the care and being with can be.
Yep.
But when we're like, it's got to move now, it's okay.
Yeah, no, We are all, it's going to be this way when we come back in the next life too. We'll be working on this. It's going to take a few lifetimes.